We often try as teachers to be kind of well organized and to cover one thing at a time.
I've said it, you maybe have heard it in a staff lounge or said it yourself, but why is it they don't remember what I taught?
And now it's time for another Edulicious episode of the Bentley Brothers Podcast, bringing you what's current and what works in education. Here are your hosts, Scott and Tim Bentley.
Bentley Brothers, Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bentley Brothers, yep. Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Yep. First name Bentley, last name Brothers, bringing education information like no others, yep. With Tim and Scott.
Sponsoring today's show is ListenWise. Scott, do you ever use ListenWise in your classroom?
Oh, I love it. It's a great tool to get your kids listening to current events from NPR that are, Tim, they're all like organized for you so you can connect it right to your content. It's a fantastic tool. I love it.
It must cost a fortune, huh?
Well, they got free accounts, man. So if you're a teacher, there's not really an excuse not to use it. And Tim, I know this is a huge thing. It's like when you get we're getting our new teacher editions this year for our new language arts. And it's all text, and that's fantastic, but where do you bring in the listening piece? This is such a great tool to address those listening standards as well as help your kids get used to that listening comprehension. And we're going to connect it right now in just a second, Tim, to you. How is that going to impact, or will it impact, or help their memory?
Hey, good point. So go to listenwise.com to sign up for free and get started having your kids listening to some great content and working on comprehension for listening skills, which of course is one of the four language arts standards, right? All right.
Absolutely, bro.
Yeah, right on. So today we are super privileged to have distinguished researcher from the Department of Psychology at UCLA. We have Dr. Robert Bjork on with us today. And not only is he a distinguished researcher, he is also a former caddy from Minnesota. Dr. Bjork, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm happy to participate.
Thank you. And so what does being a caddy have to do with being a distinguished researcher?
That is kind of an interesting place to start. but in a way, it's a good place to start. Being a caddy back in Minnesota was a way to make some money in the summer. And eventually, that led me to getting an Evans Caddy Scholarship that supported my going to University of Minnesota. A very key event, and where I was a math major actually before going on to Stanford University in a program in mathematical psychology, and that gradually led me to interests in how people learn and remember or fail to learn and remember, both in actual training of skills, as for example in golf, but also, of course, more relevant to your program, learning in the classroom, learning on your own outside the classroom.
Yeah, Dr. Bjork, we're so grateful to have you here to shed some light on something, especially to have a global leader that really understands us and can connect us, the practitioners that are out there in the classroom, to how we can most effectively impact students' learning and specifically with their memory. Can you talk about something that, you know, I know you're doing research on and have done research on is retrieval strength and storage strength. Could you talk just a little bit about what that is and then maybe mention some impacts for the classroom that teachers should be using to frame how they approach this new school year?
Yeah, that's a kind of theoretical distinction that's guided a lot of our research. Retrieval strength just has to do with how accessible something is, a skill or knowledge or something from your memory right now. Storage strength reflects how kind of interconnected that information is with everything else, you know. What it's closely related to is a very old distinction in research on learning, the distinction between learning and performance. And basically, performance is what you can see right now. And that's a product of local conditions, local cues, recency, and so on. Learning reflects the kind of encoding that will lead you on the long term to be able to remember that information and to apply it to where it's relevant. So many decades ago, in experiments with both humans and animals, they showed that considerable learning could happen when there were no systematic changes in performance. I won't go into those studies, but more recently, the flip side turns out to be true as well, namely that when there can be very considerable changes in performance and apparent learning without actual learning going on. And the real relevance of this to all of us who are teachers is that we can't just take what we see in the moment in terms of a student's abilities to answer question, perform some kind of skill as evidence of learning, because it can be a property of local conditions and cues and recency, and is very often not only a unreliable guide to whether learning's happened, but the real importance of this recently is that a lot of conditions that make performance improve very rapidly are very ineffective for long-term learning. So you can be led as a teacher to do things that lead to local changes and improvement in performance, but are not the things to do if you're trying to enhance the real target of instruction, which is actually learning and remembering on the long term and applying that information.
So Dr. Burke, how do we know if somebody learned something then?
Well, the only really reliable indicator is whether it can be produced at a delay and in another situation, or it can be applied where it's relevant to some kind of real world problem. And so that makes it a real challenge for teachers, because there are these manipulations that will make performance improve very rapidly. For example, keeping situation constant and predictable, massing or blocking instruction on a single topic. There's a whole set of these things that will make performance improve very rapidly, but then do not support long-term retention and transfer. And on the other side of that is there's these set of things I've come to call desirable difficulties. Conditions of instruction that create challenges for the learner, appear to be impeding learning when you're looking at performance, but then those are associated with long-term benefits, long-term learning, ability to transfer, and so on. And there's a number of examples of some of those, and I don't know the degree to which you want me to get into examples, but...
No, Dr. Bjork, I mean, this rings true with just personal observation. Obviously, I don't have a wide frame of research in this area, but just with seeing students who struggled with topics come back a few years later and have, you know, far exceeded in that. I don't know if there's an exact connection to this, but what I was curious about when you're talking about this is there a major implication of what you're talking about on, like, standardized testing? Are we doing this all wrong? Are we spending money in a horrible way? Or is there actually a value to that?
Well, a standardized testing is kind of good or bad depending on basically the quality of the test. And the assuming that some kind of standardized testing is a good test, one that really tests knowledge and tests what you want students to achieve, then in many ways, if that's the sort of criterion measure, that then can encourage us to incorporate better conditions of learning, even if those at the time pose some challenges and appear to be slowing down. That is, if what counts is the final performance when it matters, then there's a whole set of manipulations that these kind of desirable difficulties I mentioned that we should be incorporating as instructors. And just one example is we often try as teachers to be kind of well-organized and to cover one thing at a time. Sometimes that's now referred to kind of blocking instruction by topic. There's a whole body of recent research now saying that that will not produce as good long-term recall and transfer as you will get if you sort of interleave the instruction on different topics. If you come back to a topic after a delay rather than covering it and dropping it and going on to the next thing. And this is related in part to some real time-honored research on what's sometimes called the spacing effect. And what that refers to is if you're going to study something twice, or as a teacher you're going to cover it twice, and you could do it, go over it again right away to be sure students have got it, or you can go on to other things and then come back to that topic. It's in that second case where you give it what we call a spaced repetition of the material that will produce enhanced long-term recall.
Now, is there any research? Go ahead.
Sometimes twice the level that you would get if you just went over it twice right in a row. So that's sometimes called a spacing effect. It's a very, very general effect, but one that we as teachers just have to know about, namely, if we're going to go over something again.
For sure. Now, is there any research that shows what that spacing should be?
You know, there is, but it's complicated in the sense that you need to know what the final retention interval is going to be. How long from the second time you covered it to the criterion test, how long will that be? And basically, the longer that final retention interval, the longer you should space the interval between the repetitions. So it's not one particular number measured in hours or days or weeks or something, but it's that kind of ratio that matters. And in general, the spacing interval should be about a third of what the final retention interval is, just as a rough guideline.
Dr. Brewer, can that vary from person to person, I'm assuming?
It can vary, not like as a matter of individual style or personality, but it can vary in the sense that it can vary with how much a given student knows already, how much they bring to bear from all of their prior experience. And that'll influence many aspects of instruction in terms of optimizing instruction. Basically, what does a given student already know can matter a great deal.
Wow. So interesting. Go ahead, Scott.
No, this is just blowing me away because the implications of like how we approach instruction are just, and approaching different students, and like, I mean, it's just, it's awesome to hear this.
So,
you know, and for teachers listening out there, the problem it creates in a way is doing various things to optimize instruction can make you look disorganized as a teacher.
Right.
And you know, everywhere in the world, whether you're talking about people getting tennis lessons from an instructor or in classrooms, things are blocked, and teachers work hard to create a course syllabus that is nicely, quote, organized, where one topic is finished and you go on to another topic. And if you take this body of research seriously, which we all should, you end up looking to students a bit as though you're being kind of haphazard and jumping around, and you know, it creates a different kind of experience than students expect or are used to. And the fact that it will enhance long-term learning very substantially only becomes apparent after a delay. So,
wow.
You know,
I mean, that feels too, Dr. Bjork, like it's come in like not knowing what to expect, and they almost are more attentive or, I don't know, focused because of that unsure feeling of not knowing what's going to happen today. Whereas if it's so structured and they know it's going to be that block style, that blocking style, it's like they can more easily tune out almost.
Yes, and they can, you know, they can expect to be taught the way they have been taught. And, you know, when a teacher comes back to a topic about something they covered and now raises issues like, how does that concept we went over before apply to this new situation? You know, that's kind of a challenge, and it's exactly the kind of mental activity that leads to comprehension and understanding, but it's not something students are really used to. And so there's a kind of socialization issue. And it's not just actually, this work is so important, it's not just in the classroom. I mean, I was once interviewed at a golf driving range for National Public Radio, and the whole point of it was, just watching what was in front of us, are people practicing in the right way? And it's just amazing, you know, that there too on the golf driving range, everybody thinks they should block practice, just stand all lined up to all the lines and hit the same club over and over again. And now we know that that is the absolute worst thing from the standpoint of long-term learning. There ought to be different targets, switching between different clubs, interleaving short clubs, long clubs, a whole bunch of things like that. But if you go, so people just have in mind that they should kind of block instruction, block practice. And so the implications of this more recent research on the power of spacing and interleaving are pretty dramatic. And sometimes also, you know, for the teachers listening to this, a challenge too has to do with kind of administrative instructions. That is, teachers get under constraints like, you know, in terms of the standards covering certain things in certain order and so on. And this kind of work says that you would do it in a different way and not follow things in one particular lockstep order. And so sometimes teachers can be afraid of what their principals will think of them. And it's been interesting collaborating with some teachers in England, so different administrative structures over there give individual instructors much more freedom about how they go about things. And there's been a lot of progress over there in trying to incorporate these sort of desirable difficulties into instruction.
Wow, this is just, I mean, there's so many things that we could ask you about and talk about here. This is the tip of the iceberg, I'm sure, of your research. And you know, in learning about this, it makes me think that we're going to probably have to throw out pretty much 95% of the curriculum that we're given to teach kids, because it's all grouped.
Well,
it's all organized and grouped.
You know, if all this research that we've seen mostly in laboratory studies does generalize to the classroom, and so far in every case where that's been tested, it looks like it's true. It has dramatic implications for instruction, and some of these things where people have taken to the classroom are pretty dramatic. So, for example, Douglas Rohr, who's a researcher at the University of South Florida, has been carrying out a study in the schools in that area on algebra instruction. And basically, he's tested whether a curriculum in the domain of algebra that interleaves instruction on different topics rather than going through in the normal blocked way will enhance, and he's found very positive results so far. So it does look like these laboratory research does extend to the classroom, but there's a lot more of that kind of research to do.
Well, consider me a volunteer, Dr. York.
Hey.
And I'm in Southern California, so.
All right, there we go.
Well, you got two volunteers now.
Hey, Tim.
Yeah.
I'm sure after the show goes live, I think we'll have quite a few volunteers wanting to make sure, because there's so many teachers that we talk to, Dr. Bjork, and really want to make that impact and get frustrated. And you hear from the teacher ahead of you, like, oh, the kids didn't remember that. It's like, we want to get there. It's just not knowing how to get there sometimes is a very frustrating aspect of teaching, and you keep shifting and trying to make that impact as best you can.
Inspiring to us when we've talked to teachers, just basically the absolute focus teachers have on trying to help students, trying to enhance their long-term learning, whatever. And so in some cases, it's where we can see that some, you know, gifted and devoted teacher has been, you know, being guided, let's say, by the immediate impact or current performance into non-optimal conditions learning. It's a little shocking when we from our perspective as researchers, think that that person is in some ways being misled by what they're seeing moment by moment in terms of conditions of instruction. So the implications are pretty broad and fairly dramatic if, again, all of these findings hold up in the context of actual classrooms.
Yeah. So this is good news for all of us ADD teachers that just
can't stick
with one thing for very long, because I'm totally like that. But speaking of ADD, we're going to just jump around with you a little bit right now. We're going to play a little game with you, if you don't mind. So Dr. Bjork, you are a leading researcher from UCLA and, well, from the whole world, really, pretty much. So we thought we'd play a little game with you today that we're calling UCLA When the Smog Clears. I'm sure you've heard that said before.
All right.
We'll be asking you three questions only real UCLAers would know the answer to. Scott, why don't you tell our audience who Dr. Bjork will be competing for today?
Dr. Bjork, you'll be competing for Ashley Jones, a third grade teacher in Richardson, Texas. If you're able to answer two out of the three questions correctly, Ashley will be awarded a free download of an album by the ridiculously popular edgy rock band, Rockin' the Standards. Tim?
All right. So, Dr. Bjork, here we go with our first UCLA question for you. Number one, UCLA has more students apply to its university than any university in the nation, over 100,000 every year, or at least this past year. But not all of these students have, well, exactly stellar GPAs. What is the lowest unweighted GPA of any student applying to your prestigious university for this coming school year? Is it A?
1.14, Tim's GPA.
Or is it B?
1.71, my GPA.
Or is it C?
2.39.
Jana's GPA.
Even 2.39 seems low, but it must be 2.39.
Well, believe it or not, you've got somebody trying to get into your college that has a 1.71 GPA.
Oh. You mean trying to get in
Yes.
Admitted.
Yes, I should have clarified
that. I missed that one. All right. Yeah. I think it's because you guys weren't clear.
I think so.
That's on us for sure.
We'll take the blame for that one. Yeah, can you imagine? Let's see, 1.71. I don't really do GPAs. Is that a
No, high? They can find out there. They can find out in advance that they one of the things that I know you run out of time, but one of the things that makes the number of students applying to UCLA so impressive is just that they can calculate for themselves whether they're eligible. So means it eliminates a lot of people to start with. And even then, there's that number of applications.
Well, and 1.71, that's like a C-minus average. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So that means they're getting a lot of D's and F's, and they think they're going to get into UCLA.
Yeah. And it's not true for athletes even. So we have high standards for athletes.
It's good to think positive and believe in yourself, I guess.
I guess. But it's also good to be realistic. Okay. Number two, UCLA only teaches the facts. Of course, we know that. Which of these is not a fact about UCLA? Is it A?
During finals week, UCLA has a tradition called the Midnight Yell, where stressed out students take a break from their books screaming for minutes.
Or is it B?
There's an old network of underground tunnels that run through UCLA's campus, which leads to the underground cavern near the law school.
Or is it C?
Legend has it that William Andrews Clark is buried under the fourth step of the UCLA library named in his honor. New students are told to never step on it because, well, it's bad luck if you do.
All right.
Is
so
it
those.
Supposed to be an easy question?
Yeah, this is a real easy question, isn't it?
Okay.
So one of these is not a fact about UCLA. Is it the Midnight Yell? Is it the Underground Caverns? Or is it William Andrews Clark buried under the fourth step, being bad luck to step on that step?
Let's do the Clark.
Hey, you got it right. That's
yes.
Right.
Woo!
Woohoo! It's actually, there is a legend about Jan's, do you know Jan's Hall?
Jan's Step, yeah.
Jan's Step, where I guess one of the Jan's brothers is supposedly buried under the sixth step and you can't step on it, but not the library.
Okay.
All right, we've got one more question for you. UCLA offers...
Okay, Ashley, I hope I can do it for you.
Okay, come on. Pressure's on. UCLA offers right. Some pretty cool classes, but they also have some pretty bizarre offerings. Which of these is not an actual class offered at UCLA? Is it A?
Animals in Translation, Evolutionary Approaches to Animal Thinking and Autism.
Or is it B?
World Arts, Aliens, Psychics, and Ghosts.
Or is it C?
Elvish, the language of the Lord of the Rings.
Okay,
wow.
So one of these is not a class. That means the two of them are classes offered at UCLA.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised they're not all classes here. But
okay, so the choices are the animals teaching us about autism and animal thinking, the alien psychics and ghosts, or the Elvish language from Lord of the Rings.
Let's try the Elvish language, but it actually does sound like that could be a course, too.
Well, you got it right. That
class,
that class is not offered at UCLA, but believe it or not, it's offered at the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, right. I mean, I could imagine that course, sure.
There's yes. A lot of badgers walking around speaking Elvish, huh?
Right.
All right. So how did Dr. Bjork do today, Scott?
Great job, Dr. Bjork. You got 2 out of 3 correct, and that's good enough to be a winner. Congratulations, though. You've won nothing, but Ashley, in Texas, he just won a free download of Rockin' the Standards albums, education, rock and roll music for 2nd through 6th graders. Jim?
Oh, boy. Okay.
All right. And Dr. Bjork, thanks so much for being a good sport with us. And before we let you go, can you let our listeners know how they can learn more from you? Because we probably covered about 1/100th of 1/1000th of a percent of your body of research today. Where can they learn more about the implications for their classroom from your research?
Well, one thing would be to just go to our lab website. It's called the Bjork Learning and Forgetting Laboratory. And even that title reflects that to enhance learning, you have to introduce some forgetting. But if they go to that, they'll see a lot of things in terms of videos, articles, and so on. As far as a particular reading, once they go there, there's a little short article that Elizabeth Bjork and I wrote called Making Things Hard on Yourself, But in a Good Way, Creating Desirable Difficulties to Enhance Learning. We addressed that article to students, and I think teachers in your audience would find that a very short and sort of interesting article in terms of applying some of the things we've said.
Hey, Dr. Bjork, we're so grateful to have you come on the show and for taking the time to share with the audience. And we just wanted to thank you again for the time.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I'm glad you're doing this.
Yes.
And doing this program.
I also want to mention that Dr. Bjork has some YouTube videos that folks might want to check out and watch that you can learn from his lectures and so on in there. So again, thank you so much for joining us today. We hope to have you on the show again because, wow, there's so much more to learn from you. And thanks for listening, everyone out there. And thanks for listening.
So I could be one of those.
Mom and Dad.
Mom and Dad. Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Yeah. Bedley Brothers, Bedley, Bedley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bedley Brothers, Bedley, Bedley Brothers, bringing